And Justice Papik is recused in this matter. Mr. Swoboda, good morning to you. And you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Swoboda, and I represent the appellants in this matter. Today we're seeking a reversal of the trial court's order dismissing this case under the statute of limitations. At the outset, I would say that our complaint identified a number of claims that were, in fact, within the statute of limitations. We laid those items out in pages number 33 and 34 of our initial brief. I'd just like to talk about a few of those because they're important, and it shows, I think, that the district court missed a couple of these items. First, we identified that Dr. Garvey was getting advice from Sean Mullen that was to dissolve Midlands Oral Health. And that advice was given in March of 2011. This case filed in March 4th, 2013. The advice was to dissolve Midlands Oral Health. Dr. Caldwell was not aware of that advice, and it was certainly contrary to Dr. Caldwell's business interest for Dr. Garvey to get that advice from Sean Mullen. Sean Mullen is also providing services to Dr. Caldwell, which is the reason for the conflict. At the same time, Sean Mullen is providing that advice to Dr. Garvey. Dr. Caldwell is making a significant investment in a company called RMR, which was going to build a building to house Midlands Oral Health. So you can see another instance of the conflict. There's also a couple of identified tax returns and form filings that were for 2010. Those filings weren't actually filed until March of 2013. Those filings, we believe, were inaccurate and formed the basis for a valid claim being filed in March of 2013. Another recurrent theme in this case is that Sean Mullen failed to return Dr. Caldwell's file when he asked for it. And that's important because Dr. Caldwell is trying to understand...
Is that in your pleadings?
The failure to return the file? No, but it is in the record, and it is in Dr. Caldwell's deposition and his affidavit that he made numerous efforts to obtain his file, and they were denied.
Help us, if you can, what are the crucial dates here and what are the running times?
Okay. So as it relates to these claims, the complaint was filed March 4th, 2013. Okay? And a number of these items that I'm talking about, which are, again, on pages 33 and 34 of our brief, are in March of 2011. Okay? So our filing is March 4th or March 3rd, one of those two. These other filings would be subsequent to that, okay? Mid-March 2011, those kinds of things, okay? Dr. Caldwell didn't get his file for years after the filing of this complaint, okay? There's also...
So you're arguing these items are within the statute of limitations. This is not a tolling argument.
Yeah. Tolling and continuous representation set aside, these claims are within the statute of limitations. And I wanted to point that out at the outset because, you know, it's significant that we're not needing to rely on those continuous tort and continuous representation theories for these particular aspects. There's also billings for Midlands by Sean Mullen. Sean Mullen is sending a bill to Midlands post-March 2011, where he's billing Midlands for the advice that he's giving to Dr. Garvey. Okay, and I think appellees will admit that there was some work that was done.
Is that in your pleadings?
Is that part in our pleadings? If it's not in the pleadings, it's definitely in the record and in the exhibits that were presented on the summary judgment. Sean Mullen advertises as a tax lawyer. He's a Nebraska lawyer. He's bound by the Nebraska rules of professional conduct, like we all are, particularly in this case, the rules on conflict of interest. But he didn't follow those rules. He set those aside. He operates by a different set of rules. For years, he failed to disclose those conflicts of interest to Dr. Caldwell. Dr. Caldwell is entitled to his undivided loyalty, and he failed to provide that. when he's advising Dr. Garvey and using information that he gets from Dr. Caldwell to give Dr. Garvey an advantage in the litigation between Dr. Caldwell and Dr. Garvey. It's a violation of the rules of professional conduct, it's a breach of his fiduciary duty, and it's malpractice. And not only is it malpractice, it's another instance of malpractice to fail to disclose it. He has a duty to disclose that malpractice, which he never did. With regard to the continuing tort theory, okay, which is pled in the complaint, notwithstanding the appellee's argument that it wasn't, Sean Mullen systematically concealed the conflict of interest for years from Dr. Caldwell. This is likely why Sean Mullen didn't turn over that file for years. He's using the concealment of it to his advantage to escape responsibility by claiming the statute of limitations. His advice to Dr. Garvey at Dr. Caldwell's expense cost Dr. Caldwell hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sean Mullen became aware of Dr. Caldwell's financial condition through his representation over a number of years. And that information was used to Dr. Caldwell's detriment. To suggest in their brief that there was no longer a conflict of interest because Dr. Caldwell terminated the relationship sometime in April of 2011 ignores the rules on conflicts of interest. You don't unlearn the stuff that you gain as an attorney simply because that client has terminated your services. Sean Mullen had all that information from those years of representing Dr. Caldwell, and he used that against Dr. Caldwell. The rule prohibits giving advice to a current client about a former client in a matter between the two. The rules prohibit an attorney from using confidential information obtained from one against another. And that's exactly what Sean Mullen did in this case.
Doesn't your argument again obviate the need for a statute of limitations?
No, it doesn't.
How would the statute of limitations ever run?
Well, the difference in this case is concealment. And that's a key factor here. And if you don't provide notice and you don't get a waiver, that conflict of interest is hidden. Okay? It has to be made present, and it's Sean Mullen's duty to reveal that. Now, the continuous tort theory assists in that somewhat, and we have alleged that. But I would like to give you an example of the nature and the deep-seatedness of the conflict, and that has to do with the 18% lease back. And if you're not familiar with that, the circumstances are Midlands Oral Health is owned by Dr. Caldwell and Dr. Garvey separately, but they have entities which own half of Midlands Oral Health. Dr. Garvey has an entity which Sean Mullen and he, on paper only, transferred all of the employees to Dr. Garvey's entity, unbeknownst to Dr. Caldwell. And Dr. Caldwell's entity, in other words, and Midlands Oral Health, paid an 18%, sometimes 20%, lease back for those same employees that Dr. Caldwell thought he was paying out of his own entity. And it's okay if Dr. Caldwell knows about it and consents to it, but it wasn't that way. It was hidden. And Dr. Caldwell actually didn't find out about the lease back until August of 2011. So again, that part would be within the statute of limitations. This lease back went on for years. And had it been disclosed back in the mid-2000s that there was this conflict, I'll bet you many of these acts would never have happened because Dr. Caldwell wouldn't have allowed it. And that's the problem. We have the non-disclosure and hiding beneath that non-disclosure to avoid accountability. And that's what this case is about. I'd like to save just a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
I approach, Your Honor.
You may indeed. Is it Mr. Goodman?
It's actually Mr. Hargens.
Okay, Mr. Hargens, good morning to you.
Good morning. May I grab some water before I get started?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bill Hargens, and I represent the appellees in this action, who I will refer to collectively as Mr. Mullen, unless otherwise indicated. Likewise, I will refer to the appellants as Dr. Caldwell, unless otherwise indicated. Your Honors, after 5 years of litigation, three sets of lawyers, two sets of pleadings, a small mountain of paper that was introduced into evidence in the lower court, Dr. Caldwell has failed to come up with a single, not one, genuine issue of material fact which would preclude the entry of summary judgment on all six of the specific allegations of negligence that were included in both of its pleadings. Now, in a last-ditch effort to try to salvage some part of their claim, they argue for the first time on appeal that the continuing tort doctrine, which was adopted by this court in Alston, somehow salvages a part of its claims. But if we look closely at Alston, it's really not applicable here. It doesn't change the statute of limitations analysis at all. In fact, what this court said in Alston, and I'd like to quote, a claim for damages caused by a continuing tort can be maintained for injuries caused by conduct occurring within the statutory limitations period. Seen in this light, the continuing tort doctrine is not a separate doctrine or an exception to the statute of limitations, as much as it is a straightforward application of the statute of limitations. It simply allows claims to the extent they accrue within the limitations period. And if I may, I'd like to focus on the limitations period and then talk a little bit about what Alston teaches us in terms of what is or is not included under the so-called continuing tort doctrine. Now, as counsel pointed out, this action was filed on March 4th of 2013. So our key date is March 4th of 2011. Now, what Alston tells us is if there is tortious conduct that causes an injury after that date, then it's within the limitations period. However, what Alston also tells us is that the continuing tort doctrine does not allow a plaintiff to pursue claims based on acts of negligence that occurred before March 4th, 2011, or for any damages that occurred before March 4th of 2011, or for the lingering effects of tortious conduct that occurred before March 4th, 2011. And importantly, although this isn't discussed specifically in Alston, it's obvious that in order to have a claim for professional negligence, there needs to be a professional relationship, which we just heard, and it's conceded in their brief as well, was terminated here on April 23rd of 2011. So there's our focus of inquiry. What negligent acts occurred?
So everything plaintiffs are arguing happened after that, or you would characterize as lingering effects?
There's some of both, Your Honor, and I'm going to go through, time permitting, as many as I can, and certainly the ones that counsel just mentioned. And I want to focus first on this so-called advice that Mr. Mullen gave to Dr. Garvey to dissolve Midlands. Now, that's based entirely on a memorandum. It's in the record. I encourage you all, please, read it. It's a page and a half long. It's drafted by Mr. Jung, an employee of Hancock and Dana. It's dated March 9, 2011. It's Exhibit 7, Exhibit D to Exhibit 7, which I believe is an affidavit. And it's base stamped HD25777-78. All that memorandum did was take two documents that governed Midland's oral health and summarize them. That's it. There's no advice in there to do anything. There's nothing in the record that indicated anybody advised Dr. Garvey to do anything. In fact, ironically, and this is in the record, it was Dr. Caldwell who sued Dr. Garvey asking to dissolve Midland's oral health. Now, and I was representing Dr. Garvey at the time, We filed a counterclaim also seeking dissolution, and eventually the judge in that case did dissolve the entity. The practices were auctioned, and then we settled the case at the end of 2011 when Dr. Caldwell was represented by Mr. Domina. That's the same Mr. Domina, by the way, who advised Dr. Caldwell regarding potential claims against Mr. Mullen. And one thing we didn't hear from counsel was it is absolutely undisputed in this case that more than a year before this lawsuit was filed, more than a year, well more than a year, Dr. Caldwell knew each and every claim that he asserted in his complaint. And they don't appeal that. There's no appeal of the fact that the discovery rule does not salvage any claims by Dr. Caldwell in this case. So, back to the memo. The memo summarizes what the author believed were the relative rights and obligations of the parties under the agreement. How did that cause Dr. Caldwell damage? Remember, it's not enough to just have a tort. You have to have damage that goes with the tort. How did that damage Dr. Caldwell? Now, they argue in their brief he's damaged by that and other services that were provided by Mr. Mullen because Middle-Azora Health paid for those services, which they argue only benefited Dr. Garvey. Well, I don't think that's supported by the record. But more importantly, that claim, if it's anybody's claim, is Midlands Oral Health's claim. It's a separate legal entity. If it was paying for services that were being provided just to benefit one of its two owners, that's Midlands' claim. Dr. Caldwell can't assert claims on behalf of Midlands, nor does he even attempt to. There's no reference in any of his two complaints that he's bringing an action here derivatively or otherwise on behalf of Midlands Oral Health. I'd like to mention a couple other of the specific actions which counsel mentioned. First of all, the so-called employee transfer and this leaseback fee. It's undisputed that the transfer that Dr. Caldwell claims was effectuated by Mr. Mullen occurred in 2005. There's no evidence that Mr. Mullen had any involvement in these actual leaseback payments, as they characterize it. So at most what we have here, Your Honors, is to the extent it's within the statutory period, after March 4, 2011, it's the lingering effects of the negligent acts that were done before that date. And even under the continuing tort doctrine, those cannot be pursued.
And that pertains to this 18% leasing fee as well?
Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
Commencing in 05.
They claim that it started back in 05, yes, Your Honor, or somewhere around there. They're not completely clear on that. But what they're trying to do now, Your Honor, is say, well, those leaseback payments continue after March 4th of 2011, so we should be able to get those, not under Alston. That's the
New day one every month. That's the suggestion.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
The RMR. Now, first of all, Your Honor, in their brief, they insinuate that Mr. Mullen, on the one hand, was advising Dr. Garvey to dissolve Midlands, which he wasn't. And then they say, at the same time, he knew that this RMR company, of which Dr. Caldwell was one of three partners, was being formed to build a building. Now, in their brief, and I encourage you to look at the exact language in their brief, at page 26, they say they are entitled to pursue a claim for damages incurred by RMR in constructing that building and other expenses. RMR in the plaintiff. Dr. Caldwell can't assert a claim on behalf of RMR. Dr. Caldwell hasn't purported to assert a claim on behalf of RMR. In fact, it was not one of the six specific acts of negligence that were pled in their complaint. Regarding the K-1s, and counsel referred to them there as tax forms, what actually Dr. Caldwell says is, Mr. Mullen, you prepared my 2010 K-1 for Midlands Oral Health, which was an LLC, and you prepared my 2011 K-1, and they were both wrong. Well, according to their pleadings, the 2011 K-1 was prepared in January of 2011. That's shown in the record at Exhibit 3, page 10. Secondly, with respect to the 2012 K-1, Mr. Mullen didn't prepare it. It was prepared by an accountant hired by the receiver who Mr. Caldwell, through Mr. Domina, sought to be appointed to govern, to take care of the affairs of Midlands Oral Health after he filed his lawsuit. And so at that point, the receiver had taken over. He went out and hired his own accountant to file the 2011 tax papers. And again, that's in the record. It's Exhibit E9. It shows at the bottom, signed by Mr. Stallnecker, who was the receiver at the time, prepared by Mr. His name was Pleiss. Regarding the refusal to return the file, he knew everything more than 1 year before this lawsuit was filed. The file had nothing to do with it. Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that the judgments of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 32 seconds, Mr. Svoboda.
Two things I wanted to say.
What's your strongest argument here?
I think that the discovery rule doesn't apply as it relates to the continuous tort theory, as counsel suggested, number one. Number two, we did plead that in our amended complaint. It's paragraphs 49 through 55. And so we respectfully ask that you reverse the trial court and remand this for further proceedings. Unless you have any further questions, I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.